I'm a dreamer. Some of you know only too well that I can break things and not be able to fix them, that I can't put things together very well, that I'm just not handy. But I can dream. And this particular dream, I remember when it first came to me. A year and a half ago, I did my annual sojourn right before Memorial Day to take flowers to graves of loved ones and then to visit other ones. And I always go west on 74 and then go north to the little town of Neponset where my dad's family is all buried, and he's from a very big family. So I go to all those graves, and it ends up being a long sojourn, and I won't go into that because it's a whole day thing of many, many cemeteries. But it was at this particular cemetery that I was standing at the grave of my aunt. And I just remember thinking, what I often think when I come to a tombstone is it doesn't tell enough. It just gives name, date of birth, date of death. And I thought, what would happen if, with today's technology, we put a little chip on the tombstone, and you could come along with your smartphone and access that code, and here's the story of that person's life. You could have pictures, you could have video, you could have all these kinds of things. Now, what? Hey, I see, yeah. And so there are a few people in here, including one Andrew Hughes, who is the, well, to me, to him, technically, I'm a slug, and he is a mind, okay? And that'll make sense later, Andrew, all right? Because that's his world, the world of emerging technology and how to apply it. In this very office, I said, I have this idea. And I was just hoping he'd say, oh, I want to run with that. Because remember, I can't really do anything. All I can do is dream stuff up. And he said, hey, that's not a bad idea. Okay, bye. So I remember telling Brandon the idea and Bob and maybe some others of you this idea. Sad day, friends. I have to come up with a new retirement plan. Micah? Drat it. Someone else. Or did someone in this room leak the idea? He's hiding back there. Yeah. Here's the truth. Something wonderful can be thought of, but unless you make it happen, it's not worth much. It's not worth much. We're starting every week of Isaiah in the New Testament. And today we're in Galatians 4. So please open to Galatians 4. Verse 4. There's so much in this verse. So much. We can't do it justice, but we'll use it to launch our discussion today. But when the fullness of time had come, I just want to encourage us to understand that in God's economy and God's view of things, and in how he deals with us, I really believe this, that he has a time, a fullness of time. And I just know in our lives, quite often, we feel like we've waited and we've waited and we've hoped. Maybe we've dreamed. And what we have waited for, what we've hoped for, has not come about. If it is to come about, it will come about when the fullness of time has come. God sent forth his Son, born of woman, born under the law. Ben said it well. The Christmas story, the verses from Isaiah, the Luke and Matthew accounts, the songs, the everything can become so familiar to us that what should be astounding to us is like the just like a birth announcement. No, no. Be astounded. Be astounded. Turn to Isaiah 8, actually. We're going to spend most of our time in 9, but we're going to start in Isaiah 8. This is an important intro to the whole familiar verses about unto us a son is born. We're going to start with verse 11. For the Lord spoke thus to me with his strong hand upon me. I think that's an important thing that Isaiah is telling us here is, you know, he is kind of reluctant in all of this, and it was to cost him his life. But the Lord set Isaiah apart, and he put his hand on him, and it became a burdensome hand. Just a couple weeks ago, I did a bad thing. Someone, I won't mention names, locked their keys in their car, and we were all outside and waiting for AAA to come, and a Wesleyan professor that one of us knew happened by, and he introduced my friend introduced me to her, and I shook her hand the way I shake hands, and I hurt her. And she teaches piano, I think, or directing. I don't know. I just know that I hurt her. With all sincerity, I hurt her with the big squeeze. I put the big squeeze on. And she felt like this guy is scary. I mean, it was bad. I shake hands with a lot of gusto, and I hurt this dainty hand. We were breaking into a car at the time, trying. Why would that be her defense? Oh, okay, that too. I was the lookout, because you don't want me breaking into your car. Your car will be broken. Strong hand. You've had a strong hand on you at times, and it's like, I can't get away. I want this to let loose. Isaiah couldn't get away. I mean, we're on chapter 8. We got a long ways to go, don't we? And warn me not to walk in the way of this people, saying, do not call conspiracy all that this people calls conspiracy. Now, I just think that's so interesting. That in that society at that time, the people are all fussed up because, to me, they're paranoid. They think somebody's out to get them, when in fact it is true. And it's interesting how when Israel, and in this case it's Judah, the southern kingdom of Israel, when they're in place, there's always pressure, just like there is today, right? On Israel, there's just always pressure. And so there's a certain acknowledgement of that. But in this particular time, the people were so far from the Lord that it made them paranoid. And he is not going to honor that. So let's keep going here. And do not fear what they fear, nor be in dread. And I think that's a good message for God's people at all times. If we allow ourselves to get worked up by the culture, by the media, by whatever, losing sight of who we believe is actually in charge of the fullness of time, It will relieve a whole lot of stress. And it will give us the perspective that's needed at all times. But the Lord of hosts, him you shall regard as holy. Remember last week, our whole theme was the holiness that Isaiah encountered and then what he was to do with that. Let him be your fear and let him be your dread. Hi, I'm Pastor Dave. I'd like you to come to Jesus. Let him be your fear. Let him be your dread. But it's true. Because Jesus tells us, don't fear anything except him who has the power to send you to hell. That's not Satan, friends. That's God. Jesus doesn't anywhere say, fear what the world, the flesh, and the devil can do to you. He says quite the opposite. Don't fear it. Trust me. Have faith in me. Fear God. A holy fear of God. A holy fear of God is a healthy fear. It's a fear that recognizes beauty, wonder, glory, justice, the attributes of God. Oh, love? Understand the power of God, and you will have a right fear. Why? Keep going. And he will become a sanctuary and a stone of offense and a rock of stumbling to both houses of Israel, a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many shall stumble on it. They shall fall and be broken. They shall be snared and taken. And this happened. This happened. Now let's start. Let's move now to verse 20. Now, verse 19, and when they say to you, inquire of the mediums and the necromancers. What's a necromancer? Well, I'll just tell you. It's someone who speaks to the dead, someone who calls up the dead. Who chirp and mutter, should not a people inquire of their God? Should they inquire of the dead on behalf of the living? To the teaching and to the testimony? If they will not speak according to this word, it is because, and what a line here, friends, they have no dawn. Wow. When I read that this week, I thought of a speech that I can remember just made me feel good. And I don't remember anything else about this speech, but I remember this line. It was Ronald Reagan. He said this, it's morning in America. And I thought, by golly, what a way to look at things. It's morning in America. This is a people that has no morning. They have no dawn. And we're going to see even more. Look at verse 22. And they will look to the earth, but behold, distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be thrust into thick darkness. Not just darkness, friends. Impenetrable darkness. First weekend of December this year, there's going to be a special day on Saturday to kind of celebrate and study The Hobbit because of the movie coming out. And I've been asked on that day, and I didn't have the courage to say no. So here we go. I've been asked to speak about Tolkien, and I was given my choice of what to talk about. Well, here's what I'm going to talk about, because here's a project I'm working on, and it's a project that recognizes that both J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis had an amazing ability to describe darkness. Why? Why could these guys so describe darkness that it gives you the willies when you read it? You know why? Because they lived it. They both fought in the trenches of World War I. Lewis was wounded. His best friend was killed. But if you don't know anything about World War I, you need to. And the centennial anniversary, August 1914 is when the war started. It's coming soon, and so I'm writing this play about Lewis and Tolkien in the trenches. I think what they experienced, Tolkien was a part of the Battle of the Somme, which if you don't know about it, you can't fathom it. You can't fathom hundreds of thousands of guys dying, right? Hundreds of thousands dying right out in front of you or among you, and nothing changes. That's why it was called the war to end all wars, because it was so terrible. And, of course, that wasn't true. But the darkness of World War I changed the world's view. The 1890s and the early part of the 19th century were very optimistic times. And people were saying, we don't need the old ways. And in the Christian circles, a movement called Neo-Orthodoxy arose, which we kind of did away with that old sinful man who needs a Savior. Let's let man become who he really can become. Friends, World War I put an end to that. Darkness. Deep, thick darkness. And it spread over God's chosen people like it never had. And Isaiah is told, don't let it happen to you, and know this, and if we read far enough, we'd find this out. I have a remnant of people that I'm going to rescue from this. But the rest of them, trouble. Now, the good news. Chapter 9. But there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. See, there's a light in that, isn't it? No gloom means light. Here's some good news. There was anguish, but that's going away. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. You see, historically, those were the first two tribes of Israel that were overtaken by the enemy and murdered and dispersed and done away with. And so dark. But in the latter time, he has made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. I don't know how we can rightly understand the living in a place where the geography and the peoples of a place have so much meaning. I mean, it happens some in America, but just let me say this. Galilee was not considered the gem. People didn't go to Galilee on vacation. It was kind of pass-through land. But right here it's saying, Galilee, the glory is going to come from Galilee. So that's a prophecy. That's a prophecy. And now, a rather poetic prophecy. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shined. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. He's referencing another time of the breaking of the yoke. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult And every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. And why? Next slide. It's incredible, friends. Last week we beautifully had a dedication of Dietrich Hodel. I'm holding this little boy. For unto us, for unto you, Derek, a child is born, a son is given. This invasion of planet Earth by the Son of God is as fleshy as it can be. It's flesh and blood. It's not ethereal. It's not weird. But it is supernatural. We're told in chapter 7 of Isaiah, 7:14, that a virgin will give birth. Well, that in and of itself, that should just cause us to say, what? That doesn't happen. That's not possible. You're right. See, this whole thing is as fleshy as it can be, and it is as unusual as it can be. And so, unto us a child is born. There's so much here, and there's so much here about the vulnerability of all this. That a little baby being born is a vulnerability. Being nurtured when you're helpless is a vulnerability. There was no pediatric department back then. And I believe it's absolutely true that this baby was being protected by angels from demonic attack. He has to be protected by being taken to Egypt. This baby become boy, become man, had to be protected until it was time for him to not be protected. That's the hope of the universe? Yep. A little baby. Next slide, Micah. Okay, I'm going to ask you to read. Remember my comment that compared to Andrew, I'm a slug? For the creator of everything to become a human and to take on our nature was a dissension that we can't even define. We can't, I mean, even the slug thing fails. We can't define this creator becoming one of us. But that's precisely what happened. Let's keep going here. Leave that up. Might want to write it down or memorize it real quick. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. Of course, that means a place of responsibility and of strength and of steadiness and a burden. the government will be on him. And his name shall be called. I don't know if any of you remember this, but a few months ago I talked about the word wonderful and how in the Hebrew, I mean, this is one of those words that we have just so diminished. Because we say wonderful, oh man, that roast beef's wonderful. I've probably said that many times. But it doesn't fill me with wonder. It just fills me. Wonder. Maybe we have wonder bread. Does that fill you with wonder? No. The same Hebrew word from which wonderful comes is the word for supernatural. Now we're getting somewhere. Now, if we understand this name, we understand that this name is beyond the ordinary. It's from another dimension. This name should make our jaws drop. Counselor. That too. He knows our every thought, our every need, our every hurt, our every violation of our dignity. He knows it. And only he knows it. We don't even know. And he is able to counsel us. To be the place we go. To be the place we spew it out. And we do that when we talk to him. When we confess. When we seek. He is personal and real. Mighty God. How mighty? All authority. All power. Omnipotent, omnipotent, omnipotent. Everlasting Father. I got a picture from a cousin this week of my parents. If you've been at my house lately, you saw it. My parents probably in their mid-20s, and it looks like my dad just told a joke and my mom's laughing, and I love it. And I look at it, and I just so long to talk to my parents. But you know, this earthly parenting thing, it doesn't last forever. And they're gone. We're talking here about a father who lasts forever. Throughout the book of Isaiah, he speaks of his love for the fatherless, except in one place, a very brutal place. But otherwise, God cares for the fatherless. And finally, Prince of Peace. And simply put, again, shalom. It means more than absence of conflict. It means more than tranquility. It also means provision. It's to live in a place and in a time where there's no want of anything except more of God. And then you have it. And then you want more. And then you have it. Of course, I quoted C.S. Lewis. He very famously, in the last battle, the last of the Narnia Chronicles, kind of completes something he starts in the first, which is this concept of there's always further. Further up and further in. Further up and further in. You can never exhaust it. And that, I believe, is the way it is with the shalom of God. It cannot be exhausted. It can't be ever a place where you say, okay, that's enough. I've had enough of that. No, because it just makes you want more. And more is available. That should give us great joy. Now, next strange slide. I'm sure you all can read that, but I had to have the English put in there to help me. You know, Hebrew is not written in sentence form the way we write English, nor are many languages. And, of course, in Hebrew, you read right to left. I love this verse. In fact, of all the verses and of all the phrases that I studied this week and I searched for insights this week, this is the one. Let's read verse 7. Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. Friends, Isaiah uses this term, the zeal of the Lord, three times. And every time when we read it, here's what we see, here's what we find. God is excited. God is determined. God will not be stopped. And even though it appears in the time this is written, like this whole idea of having a holy people has just blown up in his face, it hasn't. Why? Because he is not going to lose. If he loses, the universe implodes. And what does he care about? Well, Ezekiel tells us he is so zealous because of his good name. Without him being that ultimate truth to which we look and to which we can rely on, to which, for instance, when we go to the cemetery of a loved one that we know loved Jesus, we go there and we don't despair because we know they live. When we pray for a loved one in the name of Jesus, we don't despair because we know he's here with us, with them, and his will be done. We know this about him. Why? Because the Bible tells us God can only not do one thing. He cannot be unfaithful. That's what it says. He cannot be unfaithful. He cannot be unfaithful. If that doesn't mean something to you now, it's going to. Because you are going to have times when you have only a faithful God to lean on. And when you do, you'll find him there. You'll find him there. The government will be on his shoulders. Well, I am determined that as pastor, I need to be pretty apolitical. And you're not going to hear me expound my political views because I think that steps out of who I'm supposed to be at this time. But can I say this? I get weary in these election seasons. Just get weary of it. And it's always a good reminder to me of no matter what happens in the world politically, it's moving towards something. And it's moving towards something under the control of Mr. Fullness, not Mr., Lord Fullness of Time. Is it not? And in the fullness of time, all of the angst and the agony and the things that caused World War I and World War II and all the wars, it's going to be gone. Remember how we started this whole thing? They'll beat their swords into plowshares. That's all. Because this book is about the coming of the kingdom of God. All these chapters and all the stories they tell and all the prophecies, they're about that time when God's reign is known and experienced and lived. But remember we said this, it's twofold. It's already and it's not yet. Because he came, the king came, but he came in meekness. And he came as a servant. But next time, not so meek. Not so meek. The government will be on his shoulders. You know, that's already happened. The governing of the universe has already fallen on the governing of a sinful race has already, the governing of a universe that's under a curse because everything moves towards entropy. That's already fallen on his shoulders. The next slide. Fell on his shoulders when he carried the cross, and it was so heavy and he'd been so brutalized that he had to have help. But he continued on his course, and on his shoulders, and through his hands, and through his feet, and in his side, and on his brow, he bore every dark thing. That thick darkness, that in the trenches darkness, it all went on him. Not a bit of it, not on him. And I think about this in the light of that little baby boy. And when he was born, the Father and the Spirit, in this strange, mysterious Trinitarian relationship, knew that that little boy was going to be brutalized. That their love for eternity was going to be brutalized. Yet, how much zeal does he have for you? For all of us? How much is that zeal going to accomplish if we could see? If we could see, we would be racing around here like chickens with their heads cut off, with just the joy of it all. It would be, we couldn't hold it in. But he tells us, until that day, until I return, I want you to remember me, the shoulders, carrying your burdens. Bob?